Welcome, Double Take listeners. It's always great to hit that big red record button and break sonic bread with you. I'm Rafe Lewis, head of Newton Investment Management Specialist Research Teams, and I want to start off the episode's discussion on what investors should be making of the U.S.-China tensions with a little anecdote.
Well, you always love a good anecdote, Rafe.
That's right, sir. And by the way, folks, I'm joined here by that voice there, who's my trusty sidekick, Newton Investigative Research Analyst Jack Encarnacio. Anyway, back to my anecdote. So there I was a few weeks ago enjoying breakfast with a commander in the U.S. military who will remain nameless. But they are, let's just say, crucial and instrumental in our relations and lack thereof with China. Anyway, this very high-ranking individual, I was expecting to just come out with some broad brush vagaries about how the U.S. stands at the ready, but we're all safe and we're a million light years away from any potential hostilities. And let me just tell you, I did not need coffee to wake me up at that breakfast. So this commander told us that while a hot war with China is not a 100% certainty, it is the most probable it has ever been. And that probability is only moving higher as time goes on. He said that Chinese President Xi is dead set on annexing Taiwan, either by peaceful means, by blockade, or by force sometime in the next few years, and that it is absolutely of vital importance to the USA and the world that China not achieve that goal. In other words, that Taiwan is not merely important for its high-tech manufacturing, but for the fate of democracy and civil society as we know it. Those are pretty high stakes. What's more, this commander that I met with and had breakfast with made the rather bold statement that any investment in China, be it in a private or publicly listed company or in manufacturing capabilities, you name it, is an investment in the Chinese military ultimately, and thus is funding the future death and injury of American soldiers and sailors. His point, if I analyze the situation coldly, was simple. Investors, in his assessment, are grievously underestimating the potential for war between the world's two largest economies. And by the way, this would all happen in a body of water that carries roughly a third of all global trade in any given year.
It's pretty sobering stuff, Rafe. So with that in mind, we here at Newton, and by extension, Rafe and I here on Double Take, have endeavored to spend much more time and effort understanding all the potential outcomes and lesser understood details of the U.S.-China tensions. But along the way, we've also been paying much more keen attention to the latest realities on the ground in China and whether investors are wise or foolhardy parking capital there. To help us explore some of that, we invited onto the pod none other than Professor William Kirby. Dr. Kirby is a professor of China studies at Harvard Business School, as well as chair of the Harvard China Fund, which supports research and teaching related to China. He's also the former dean of Harvard's Faculty of Arts and Sciences and the former director of Harvard's Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies. Dr. Kirby, welcome to Double Take.
It's a great pleasure to be with you both. Thank you so much for asking me.
Oh, we're really thrilled. And we should add to your bona fides, actually, that Professor Kirby is also chair of the Taiwan Fund, Inc., which is a closed-end fund that invests in the Taiwan tech sector. So I think that's probably a great place to start, Professor. You know, you guys are obviously investing in Taiwan right across the water, as we were talking about, with all those bristling with naval vessels from both countries. And maybe the first place to go is, why invest in anything in China if there's a darn good chance you're going to have to try to extract that capital and extract it very quickly at some point over the next few to several years?
Well, I'll come back to discussing views on the likelihood of war in the Taiwan Strait, because I am by no means so pessimistic. But on investing in China, that if you invest in China, you're investing somehow directly in the People's Liberation Army. I've been on other boards that have been and companies that invest in China. I've written 60 to 70 Harvard Business School cases on business in China, including American investments in China. People invest in China for the reason they invest anywhere on earth, in order to make money. And there are hundreds and hundreds of American companies, some of them downsizing or moving a little bit of what they have in China elsewhere, but they stay in China because they are actually successful, and they're investing in what has been, until the last year or so, the most rapidly rising economy over many decades on Earth and really in modern history. And they're investing disproportionately in private enterprises, not in state-owned enterprises. They're investing in the entrepreneurial spirit of Chinese business leaders. And China has a longer history of private enterprise and entrepreneurship than Europe or North America. Of course, truncated by the communists when they took over in 1950, but survives underground or overseas during the height of the Maoist period, and is now back in China and doing historically very, very well. This is not an easy time for private enterprise in China, domestic or international, because all of us are caught in the geopolitical tensions between China and the United States. And I myself am writing a series of Harvard Business School cases on how companies try to navigate these tensions and to succeed in each other's market, something that is not very easy. But I do not think it is correct. Obviously, you could invest in the People's Liberation Army related companies. A number of them are quite well known. If you wanted to, I don't recommend that. But it is simply not true that you are investing in the Chinese military if you invest in China.
So, Professor Kirby, as mentioned, you run the Harvard China Fund, which supports teaching and research into the, quote, major challenges facing Greater China. I find that most of the conversation around China regards the opportunities rather than the challenges for a country that until the COVID pandemic was growing like a proverbial weed. Can you enumerate what you see as the major challenges China faces? And as you do that, I'd love to hear your thoughts on whether each of those challenges is transitory and cyclical in nature, or perhaps more secular and long-lived.
Okay, on looking at the mainland China economy, it is, you know, first of all, we have to remember that China, that if you know some economic history, China's economy was poised to grow dramatically over the course of the 20th century, and it grew very well before the Second World War. Then the Second World War, the Civil War, and above all, the Maoist Revolution set China back dramatically while the rest of East Asia, you know, pushed forward, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong. And China has made up for lost time since 1980 or so, and has done remarkably well by freeing up entrepreneurial talent, allowing people to move to where there are jobs, even if without often job or residence security. And it has, of course, done well by re-entering global markets in a dramatic way after entry into WTO. It has, however, not proceeded with a level of legal or political reform that would be commensurate with this extraordinarily dynamic economy. And sadly, I think under the rule of President Xi Jinping, you see a return of greater state oversight over enterprise, state-owned, of course, as well as private, Chinese, as well as foreign, in a way that shakes the confidence of investors. And we're in a moment of extraordinarily low confidence on the part of the Chinese entrepreneurial class, whatever it is for internationals in this regard. You also see the kind of beginning of the end of certain models of funding enterprise and initiative in China, particularly at the local government level. With the stagnation of the real estate sector, local governments have been in China, you know, local governments gain much of their income from selling and reselling land because, bizarrely, only the government owns the land in China, and it's almost all in the hands of local governments. But when land values decrease, these areas of governance are strapped for cash. You will see in coming times a real cash crunch in local governments, which means they pay their officials less. They will tax their citizens more through all kinds of informal levies. This has happened many times in Chinese history, sadly, and it appears to be happening again. So one needs a new model of taxation as well as funding, because local governments have, as in the United States, but many more unfunded mandates from the center, such as in the time of zero COVID, testing everybody every day. massively expensive and not very effective for the economy. So there are a bunch of areas in which China could, is facing challenges. The last one I'll say is, and I've always been, and I still remain very, very positive on the long-term capacity for growth in China, because you have 200 to 300 million people in China who are still too poor to be serious consumers. If they had the social security in terms of healthcare and education for their children that a communist country ought to have, if they had that, they could enter this economy. But right now, because farmers are not allowed to own their land and they don't reinvest in it, and because the government has seriously underfunded rural healthcare and education, they save. They save massively, but they don't consume. And this leads to, this is part of the story of the current stagnation in China.
Got it. That's very interesting. So what we're seeing here is still a large piece of the population that's kind of held back from propelling the economy and their own financial fates forward, it sounds like to me. So, and I take it, it sounds like implicit in what you're saying that the private sector will play a significant role in China in kind of closing those some of these challenges that you were outlining there. For example, the unfunded mandates, there could be some solutions that come along, or maybe ways of propelling the kind of rural poor into a more material comfort. Is that your thesis, or is the government, the central government, really going to have to step in and go back to those Maoist old days of playing a bigger and bigger role?
So far, actually, neither of those things seems to be happening. You have the private sector investing heavily into high-end healthcare, into high-end education. You know, a quarter of China's universities are private universities, extraordinary new hospitals kinder care, elder care centers have sprung up by remarkable private enterprises have gained very large returns. But that's really for people of the middle class and above. And it's in the countryside. And mind you, still 40%+ of Chinese live in what one can call the countryside, not in urban areas. And it is in the countryside where you see this lack of steady progress, the lack of a social safety net that allows them to participate in this economy. You know, a great businessman once told me, a man who's one of the greatest entrepreneurs in agribusiness in the world, he once told me, a rich country cannot have poor farmers. And when you think about it, and in every enduringly rich country, whether it is the countries of Western Europe, Britain, Canada, the United States, Japan, Taiwan, they all have a vibrant agricultural sector. China only has poor farmers. But the government insists on ideological grounds of maintaining ownership of the land, so the farmers cannot use this precious commodity to advance themselves as economic actors in buying or selling land. And the government under Xi Jinping does not believe, actually, in socialism in this sense. I see you as in the farm. I think that Xi Jinping is, of course, a very committed communist in political terms, but in many ways, he seems to me not a socialist. He says he does not want to have a welfare state. Welfareism, he says, makes people lazy. Well, he sounds like a good Republican to me, but it is actually not good if you really want these people to be the next large group of consumers, a market the size of the North American population, still too poor to consume.
So, Professor Kirby, do you think it's an oversimplification to suggest that, you know, we're essentially heading to, the likelihood of war is very high between China and Taiwan, and what happens from here really kind of dictates the resources at play? I heard you push back on the notion that, you know, any investment in China is essentially an armament to the party. But the likelihood of an actual conflict there, I wonder if you could weigh in on that.
I don't think the likelihood of a conflict is as high as suggested. I actually don't think it's high at all at the moment. And much depends on what the leaders in Washington and in Beijing and in Taipei do in coming years. You know, we did actually have hostilities across the Taiwan Strait three times in the 1950s. We intervened in the Chinese Civil War by sending the 7th Fleet between the mainland of China and Taiwan at the onset of the Korean War. We supported indirectly Taiwan in the crises of 1954 and 1958, the famous Kimoi and Matsu crises, and of the since the nationalists on Taiwan held these islands just miles off the China coast and defended them with American assistance. And we were at that point very close to some larger conflagration, and it did not happen. Meanwhile, the mainland and Taiwan have prospered in a form of co-prosperity, proving to the world that two political entities and two states, one can decide politically whether they are different countries or not, but two states can have no political relations whatsoever and yet a vibrant set of economic and cultural ties. China's great boom of the 1990s, 2000s is not comprehensible without the extraordinary amount of Taiwan entrepreneurship that moves to China, up to 2 million people at any one point in time, and the number of companies that relocate to China, bringing their experience and their own entrepreneurship to bear on the mainland. There's a wonderful scholar, a friend of mine, Professor Shelley Rigger at Davidson College, who has written a book about how Taiwan companies restarted the mainland economy. And it's a fantastic read if one wants to look at this. So these two, you know, Taiwan and mainland China have much to do by cooperation and everything to lose by confrontation. I worry that Taiwan should worry about those Americans who would like to see a confrontation across the Taiwan Strait. It won't do Taiwan any good, and it is the single riskiest thing that mainland China could invest in. Just think about it. Think what would happen if there were a war in the Taiwan Strait, if China invaded or attacked Taiwan. You know, let me be very frank. I was educated in Taiwan. I learned my Chinese in Taiwan. I'm an enormous fan of Taiwan and its remarkable spirit of autonomy. And Taiwan has prospered, as mainland China has prospered, and indeed in a triangular economic relationship, the Americans have prospered by embracing diplomatic fictions, be it the One China policy or the so-called 1992 consensus between Taiwan and the mainland, agreeing to disagree about what One China actually is. These fictions have bought enormous time and they've bought prosperity. It's the job of leaders in Washington, in Beijing, and in Taipei, perhaps at the moment, to think of some new fictions, because the alternative is not it is too dark to assume. I mean, one should always be prepared for the worst, but it is too dark to assume that war is inevitable. And indeed, maybe the greatest British historian of diplomacy, A.J.P. Taylor, once wrote, "War is never inevitable until it breaks out, and it's our job to keep it from breaking out."
Professor, it sounded like you were going to go down the road of delineating for us whose interests would be served by a hot war confrontation between China and Taiwan. How do you see that?
I suppose you could argue that arms manufacturers everywhere would be served by this. But I think a confrontation with between China and Taiwan would, as I was about to say, overnight end China's international economic relations with the United States, with Japan, with Western Europe. It would cause a major international economic crisis as well, as this economy, which is so central to the global economy today, becomes much, much more insular. That's irrespective of what physical damage a war could have. A war could also do significant damage to Taiwan. One should not forget that Taiwan has airplanes and offensive capacity. A war could do significant damage to Shanghai, to Xiamen, to Fuzhou, to many cities on the China coast. It should be an inconceivable thought. One has to, if you're in Taiwan, you have to prepare for your defense. And I think the Americans have been extremely generous and helpful in helping Taiwan to prepare for its defense. We do have the Taiwan Relations Act of 1979 that mandates us to do that. But at the same time, we should not be goading the Chinese side into action in this regard. You know, I'm a huge fan in domestic U.S. politics of Nancy Pelosi, but I thought her visit there was extremely irresponsible and made Taiwan less secure rather than more secure.
Those are all excellent thoughts. Thank you very much for this. I'm really enjoying this, actually. But I want to switch a little bit now to kind of more into the direct kind of investment conversations. Professor Kirby, you know, we've seen a material drop in foreign direct investment in China in recent years. And, you know, I believe that could actually accelerate now that China considers conducting basic due diligence activity, which, by the way, is my day job, really, not this podcast. That they consider that a form of espionage. We've seen employees at Bain and Mintz Group get arrested in recent months for doing just that kind of work, just to, you know, do the preparatory work for any acquisition or investment. So I'm curious to get your take on what you think China's government hopes to achieve with this policy and this legal framework, because from where I sit, it looks to stifle investment in China at a time when their economy is wobbling and injections of capital would really be needed.
Well, I think this is incredibly counterproductive, these actions toward foreign confidence in investing in China. Mind you, our own government has, in recent years, particularly in the Trump administration, investigated and prosecuted unsuccessfully a series of Chinese-born scientists. So in international relations, there's often a quid pro quo, although I don't think this is a precise example of that. I think it would be a mistake to assume that that there is a master plan for dealing with this and for dealing with the United States and all of its dimensions in Beijing. When you say the Chinese government is doing this, whom do you mean? Well, we do know that it's state security. And state security in China is, like the People's Liberation Army, a bit of a state within the state. Its interests are not necessarily in line with that of the Ministry of Commerce or the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. You know, if you peel back the surface of the Chinese government in the press, everything is unitary. Everyone is agreed. The National People's Congress is nearly unanimous on every issue. But in fact, there are enormous disagreements under the covers, as it were, within the party and within the government. And so you will see different interest groups have different interests in this regard. And I think it is the job, presumably, of President Xi and the national leadership to rein in public security officials who are in their own minds as worried about foreigners knowing our nation's secrets as the FBI was in its rather bungling attempt to prosecute Chinese scientists wanting to know our secrets here in the United States. We're a bit of two sides of the same coin in this, but I think it's really incumbent upon the Chinese government to make it clear that all of these new rules and regulations, which are really toward their own citizens more than toward foreigners, should not are very, very counterproductive in terms of giving one confidence, the confidence that one needs in order to go ahead with investments. And that's true for Chinese investors as well in China. The one thing I say, when you think about, you read the newspapers, and they often say, China does this, China does that, China says that. Well, I've been to China hundreds of times, and I have never met China. I don't know what she looks like. I've met the leaders of the Chinese Communist Party. I've met the presidents of the country. I have met the senior business leaders and so on. They're different people. They have different interests, and they don't always agree, despite the rhetoric of unanimity that one gets from the official press. So I think we need to look at things with a little bit more complex set of glasses, a little better set of, let's put it this way, a stronger set of lenses in our glasses.
So I'm interested now, Professor, in your thoughts on, you know, you mentioned the vibrancy of the private sector and the spirit of entrepreneurship in China over the decades, and how that can be, you know, sort of walled off from state-owned enterprises when investing in China. Yet, as you just sort of telegraphed there, and as you're well aware, very often an investment in a mainland Chinese domiciled company, you have to take into consideration the possibility that, you know, the Chinese Communist Party has, you know, undue influence over those operations, or could somehow seek to co-opt those operations once the private enterprise reaches a certain level of success or scale. How would you urge our listeners to think about the degree of control the CCP has over putatively independent Chinese companies?
It's a very good question. And I think I would say the same thing about the CCP that I said about China. That is to say, there is, of course, a central committee and a standing committee overseen by President Xi. There are also 95 million other members of the Chinese Communist Party. And if you are, if you're running a business of even modest, medium to large size today in China, you will have a party committee there. But very often that party secretary is there working with the local government and the local party secretary of the municipality to help your business, not to impede it, because the success of that business is important for the GDP of that municipality. And I've met many party secretaries in municipalities who know the P&L of the companies in their jurisdictions better than any American mayor would know of the companies within their jurisdictions, because their central role over much of the last 40 years has been to promote economic growth. Universities, for example, both all have presidents as well as party secretaries. And of course, you do have some party secretaries that are very, very hard line politically. But the majority of the ones that I have met, their job is to protect the university from intrusion from the outside to the best of their ability. So the concept is much more complex. The CCP itself is not just one thing. And at the end of the day, the party, given its size and given the fact that it runs the country as a unitary party state, is everywhere. And so you have to deal with it in one form or another. But not all party members are the same, not all party units are the same, and many of them will have different interests depending on the companies they represent or the parts of the country that they run. So I don't know what the number of, I guess there aren't 95 million Republicans or Democrats that are formally registered as this, but we know that they don't always agree. The Chinese Communist Party is, to be sure, a quite different animal than those two parties, but it is not all a monolith.
That's very wise counsel, I would say. Last question from me, Professor Kirby. You know, zooming out to 30,000 feet, you know, we're talking about the Chinese government here. I'm curious to get your take on how much faith we as investors can put into the economic and trade data and all the other statistics that we gobble up in investing. You know, do you have the sense that that these are grounded in reality, or, you know, do we have to worry that this is part of a kind of a propaganda mechanism?
Well, let me put it this way. They're a hell of a lot better than they used to be. If you go back to the 1950s,
fair enough,
and the 80s, and since joining WTO, they've been much, much better. That said, the deception in these, when it exists in these GDP and other figures, are designed by and large not to deceive international investors, but to deceive Chinese leaders. You want to show that your county is growing strong. And so you measure GDP by a wide range of projects that may or may not actually be economically viable for it, but do consume resources, do employ people up to a certain period in time. And, you know, I think Chinese leaders have always taken their own statistics with a bit of a grain of salt. The late Li Keqiang, the former premier, who just passed away just a few days ago, Li Keqiang said that he implied that statistics are man-made, and therefore one should look at them with a certain degree of skepticism. What isn't, you know, one cannot fail to recognize that whatever the exact numbers are, China has had an extraordinary world-class boom over the last 40 years, and it is now stuck in long-standing problems coming home to roost, very much exacerbated by zero COVID. I believe that at the moment, we are still in what I call economic long COVID in China. And I think it will take another year or so to see what are the enduring effects of COVID, if they do endure or if they don't, because this was the battle against COVID brought the government into every enterprise and into every neighborhood in a way that it had not been really since the 1960s. And it's been very counterproductive in every possible way and resented in every possible way. So I think we will also, you know, I think one should bear in mind that this country looks, you know, it has a very strong government. It's a government that's also strongly insecure in its rule. And we have had major political changes in China over the last few months. The foreign minister disappears. The defense minister disappears. The entire leadership of the Rocket Corps disappears. Something is going on. And at some point, we will find out what it is. But China has had, from a distance, it looks to be like the most stable place on earth. And in recent decades, it has had a reasonable degree of political stability. But in the history of the Chinese Communist Party, if you're looking to the future, when President Xi eventually does step down, there has been exactly one leadership transition from one leader to another that was not accompanied by violence or a political purge. So it'll be an exciting place to be invested. Let me put it that way.
And finally, for me, Professor Kirby, you mentioned sort of how much progress China has made in terms of reliability of the GDP and other statistics that they pump out. And your point is well taken that there's just as much on the line domestically for folks proffering those statistics as there is, you know, the impression it leaves on international investors. But as China has progressed and evolved in this way, something I think investors are hungry to see is the ability to do apples-to-apples comparisons with how, you know, U.S.-listed companies or, let's say, Western-listed companies on things like the S&P 500, how they go about reporting numbers, how they go about setting best practices around things like corporate governance. Do you think there's going to be a time, perhaps in your lifetime or any medium and long-term, where we can say, you know, there's sort of like an international standard for corporate governance and Chinese companies are sort of just as likely to report out in the same way that Western listed companies do? Or is there perhaps something, you know, fundamental and endemic to the Chinese society that will keep it somewhat at odds with the standards we tend to embrace here around S&P 500 reporting companies?
No, I think there's nothing endemic to Chinese society that will keep it from doing that. Yeah, and you have a wide range of extraordinary private companies today that meet international standards on in virtually every dimension. Those that have IPO'd, a number that have not been allowed to IPO, in part because of Chinese government restrictions on what companies can and cannot do. And so were those restrictions to be alleviated and Chinese companies allowed many more of them to list in Hong Kong or in New York, you would see a large number doing extraordinarily well and meeting global standards. And you can see this if you know, look at the industries in which China is poised to lead. Look at battery materials. China is home to companies that are, even if they're largely still in China, already world class. And it would be to our advantage if we wish to have in our lifetimes a significant number, a very large number of vehicles on the road being electric vehicles, to allow them to invest in our country and to build factories and so on here. The constraints on what Chinese companies do and how they report. Of course, there are some that have significant governance issues, as there are among American companies. But mostly that is because they live in an environment never quite knowing what the next set of regulations from the government are going to be. And so they do as well as they can until the government declares that it is somehow not right what they are doing. But in a place with a stronger rule of law, with a better set of commercial laws, a better set of company laws, although China has a reasonably good one, I don't think there's any stopping Chinese companies from being as successful as any in the world.
Wow, a lot to chew on there. And I guess one of my big headline takeaways from this very informative interview, Professor Kirby, is that China is not a monolith. And really, we have to look, with a much more powerful lens, as you said, to extract the value from there. So Professor William Kirby of Harvard Business School, chair of the Taiwan Fund, Inc., and many other affiliations, thank you so much for joining us here on Double Take.
Well, thank you both so much, and I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you both.
This is a financial promotion for institutional clients only, issued by Newton Investment Management North America LLC, NIMNA, or the firm. NIMNA is a registered investment advisor with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, and subsidiary of the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation, BNY Mellon. The firm was established in 2021, comprised of equity and multi-asset teams from an affiliate, Mellon Investments Corporation. The firm is part of the group of affiliated companies that individually or collectively provide investment advisory services under the brand Newton or Newton Investment Management. Newton currently includes NIMNA and Newton Investment Management Limited, NIM, and Newton Investment Management Japan Limited, NIMJ. Any statements of opinion constitute only current opinions of NIMNA, which are subject to change and which NIMNA does not undertake to update. This publication or any portion thereof may not be copied or distributed without prior written approval from the firm. Statements are correct as of the date of material only. This document may not be used for the purpose of an offer or solicitation in any jurisdiction or in any circumstances in which such offer or solicitation is unlawful or not authorized. The information in this publication is for general information only and is not intended to provide specific investment advice or recommendations for any purchase or sale of any specific security. Some information contained herein has been obtained from third-party sources that are believed to be reliable, but the information has not been independently verified by NIMNA. NIMNA makes no representations as to the accuracy or the completeness of such information. No investment strategy or risk management technique can guarantee returns or eliminate risk in any market environment, and past performance is no indication of future performance. ESG analysis refers to a range of internal and external qualitative and quantitative research. Newton manages a variety of strategies. Whether and how ESG considerations are assessed or integrated into Newton's strategies depends on the asset classes and/or the particular strategy involved, as well as the research and investment approach of each Newton firm. ESG may not be considered for each individual investment, and where ESG is considered, other attributes of an investment may outweigh ESG considerations when making investment decisions. Analysis of themes may vary depending on the type of security, investment rationale, and investment strategy. Newton will make investment decisions that are not based on themes and may conclude that other attributes of an investment outweigh the thematic structure the security has been assigned to. If distributed in the UK, EMEA, Australia, New Zealand, this podcast is issued by Newton Limited and may be deemed a financial promotion. Newton Limited is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, 12 Endeavour Square, London, E20, 1JN, in the conduct of investment business. Registered in England, number 01371973. NIM is also registered as investment advisors with the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, to offer investment advisory services in the United States. If distributed in Canada, this podcast is issued by either Newton Limited, which is availing itself of the International Advisor Exemption, IAE, in the following Canadian provinces, Alberta, British Columbia, Ontario, and Quebec. The IAE is in compliance with National Instrument 31-103, registration requirements, exemptions, and ongoing registrant obligations, or NIMNA, which is availing itself of the IAE in the following Canadian provinces, Alberta, British Columbia, and Manitoba. The IAE is in compliance with the National Instrument 31-103, registration requirements, exemptions, and ongoing registrant obligations.